Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court's new term and examine the cases that they have decided to take up, which involve the issue of voting rights, affirmative action, the death penalty, the future of public sector unions, and abortion. Azeez Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago, who is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, joins us to discuss why the court took up these politically charged cases and whether existing rights will be stripped away by the conservative majority, weakening laws that will have a direct impact on the lives of most Americans. Then we'll assess the deal reached by the United States and 11 other Pacific Rim countries, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that faces a skeptical Congress in an election year and may or may not end up as a crowning legacy for Barack Obama. Adam Hirsch, a senior economist at the Roosevelt Institute and a visiting scholar at Columbia University's Initiative for Policy Dialogue, joins us to discuss his article with Joseph Stieglitz at Project Syndicate, The Trans-Pacific Free Trade Charade, and how the TPP tried to extend the brazen gouging underway with overpriced drugs in the United States that are couched in terms of protecting intellectual property. Then finally, we'll speak with James Gelvin, a professor of history at UCLA, whose research focuses on Syria, and discuss the piecemeal destruction of the UNESCO World Heritage Site at Palmyra in Syria, where a Roman arch that has stood for 2,000 years was blown up by the Islamic State today. While up to 300,000 Syrians have died in Syria's civil war, and most of the country lies in ruins, with half of the population refugees, we'll try to understand why these nihilistic jihadis are destroying the past in order to usher in their apocalyptic vision of a future. And joining us now is Azeez Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Azeez Haque.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And the Supreme Court on Monday have announced that they're back in their new session, their new term, and they are taking on some incredibly politically charged issues: voting rights, affirmative action, the death penalty, the future of public sector labor unions, and abortion. So this couldn't be more of a loaded session.
I think that's right, Ian, although some of these cases are likely to be more important than others. For example, the death penalty cases are cases in which the constitutionality of the death penalty is not really an issue. The issues in those cases are relatively technical. By contrast, in the affirmative action case, we really might see a ruling that terminates all forms of affirmative action in the educational context.
Well, that's a big deal, and not as if it hasn't been incrementally weakened. But what's your sense then of what the justification for this will be? Is this like the Voting Rights Act, where they say, well, we no longer need Section 5?
I think what the court will say if it takes that road will be the following. This is a case that's been to the court once before. It's a case involving somebody called Abigail Fisher, who applied to the University of Texas, was not admitted, and claims that this was because of affirmative action. I think what the court will say, having sent it back down to the lower courts to apply a more rigorous form of review, I think what the court will say is that, well, we've tried to apply a more rigorous form of review, and we see that it hasn't worked, and we're now going to end this experiment in affirmative action. I think that's the language that you would see if the court takes that route.
Well, I might let the audience know that your young child is there adding a little rather delightful little chorus to our conversation.
I was trying to keep him away from the phone, but I guess it's not going to. Don't worry about it. Your audience should take this as an argument for paternity leave, which I'm supposedly taking.
So let's turn, though, to what I think it could be a really significant ruling, and that is rulings about one person, one vote in this Texas case that does seem on the surface to be designed to dilute the Democratic votes in urban areas and increase the rural vote, which goes Republican.
Absolutely. So this case is about a legal principle called one person, one vote. that was created by a court in the 1960s as a way of ending the gross disproportionality between legislative districts, usually in urban versus rural settings. Since that doctrine was defined in the 1960s, the court has measured one person, one vote in line with the population of the state and the population of the districts within it. What the challenges in this case, in the Texas case, are proposing is to measure the districting related population, not in terms of the whole number of people in a state, but in terms of the number of voters. And as you say, this has the predictable effect of weighting districts where there are more unregistered or more people who cannot become voters, so people who are young, people who are migrants, whether documented or not. It assigns those districts less weight than districts where there are more of the people who are technically eligible to vote. And the effect of that would be to skew the political map Republican. Now, the tricky thing about this case is that, as even the challengers in the case admit, there's actually not data that allows districting maps to be drawn with voter populations. That data simply doesn't exist. The data on population as a whole comes from the census that's carried out every 10 years, but the census doesn't ask you whether you're eligible to vote. That data simply doesn't exist. So what they're asking for here, interestingly, is something that actually can't be done.
Well, but where is the legal tradition here? Is this, I would have thought, and maybe I'm naive, but I always thought one person, one vote was kind of a bedrock principle. I know we have a history in the South of supermajorities and all kinds of sophisticated ways to suppress the vote. But where is the legal precedent for undoing one person, one vote? Or what is the opening wedge that these justices
right.
might see?
One person, one vote really comes about in the 60s. There was nothing like it previously. Before that, states had pretty unfettered authority to draw their districting lines the way they wanted to. And they used that to give little political weight to cities and a lot of political weight to rural areas. And that was understood in the 1950s and 60s, at least, as one way of protecting Jim Crow in the House of Representatives and in state houses. The Supreme Court in the 1960s applied the Equal Protection Clause to redistricting for the first time, and it came up with the one person, one vote rule as the most easy to administer equality rule in the redistricting context, in a case called Reynolds v. Sims. The idea of one person, one vote really does come from the 1960s. It doesn't have a provenance before that, and it's basically something that the justices came up with. And remember here, what's at issue here is not should we have one person, one vote. It's how do you count the number of persons, right? And what the challengers are saying is, no, we want to count it this other way by looking at just a vote as not a whole population, which just happens to benefit Republicans, right? And obviously, this is a challenge brought by individuals affiliated to the Republican Party.
And again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And in terms of the death penalty case, do you think that there's a possibility that the Pope's recent visit may, I mean, what are there, five Catholics on the Supreme Court, aren't there?
There are five Catholics on the Supreme Court. I think it's probably not accurate to say that any of the justices, Catholic or Jewish or otherwise, view their religion as a source of direct instruction for their voting on the court. I think that would belittle the serious political theories that both conservatives and liberals bring to bear in their judging. So I don't think that the Pope's visit has much effect. At the end of the last Supreme Court term, there was an opinion by Justice Breyer, joined by Justice Ginsburg, in a case called Glossop, calling for the court to revisit the question of the death penalty's basic constitutionality. That big question is not before the court, and if it were before the court, it would be very divisive, I think. What is before the court are a series of much more minor questions. And I say minor with a bit of hesitation. Obviously, none of these cases are minor for the individuals involved or the families of the victims involved. They involve issues such as whether a rule that the court handed down a number of years ago about the availability of life without parole and the need for a hearing on that for juveniles is one that will apply retroactively. There's a case about precisely what kind of sentencing instructions a capital jury needs to get. There's one fascinating case which is very, very fact-bound about a prosecutor who seems to have selected a jury on the basis of race, which is plainly unconstitutional, and then hidden the evidence of that with state courts really not looking too hard to reveal that evidence. That case, I think, is important because it shows just how weak the oversight that elected state court judges will often give in capital cases. And it shows the need, therefore, for a federal court to seriously review, in particular, those cases. But these are not issues that are likely to lead to a sea change in the law as far as the death penalty is concerned.
But in terms of my mention of the Pope, I think that what the Pope is arguing here is about moral consistency, that he's pro-life in every sense, not just in terms of the abortion issue, but in terms also of capital punishment. And I was just assuming that while the justices may certainly probably don't make their rulings based on their religion, at least in terms of consistency and moral consistency, that's what I thought that the Pope was sort of pointing out, because I'm pretty much assuming that these are the same justices, these conservative justices do take a very strong position on abortion, which we can talk about in a minute.
I think that's unquestionably right as far as it as far as the Pope goes. I think I can imagine what one of the conservative justices might say in response. They might say that they have their own kind of moral consistency, and in their view of the world, the life of somebody who has committed a heinous crime is worth much less than the life of what they would say describe as the life of a fetus. And they would say that their views on abortion and the death penalty are perfectly consistent, and I doubt that what the Pope has said is going to change their mind on that.
Well, let's talk about the abortion case. It's likely to come from Texas, and already it's been clear what's happened in Texas with these restrictions and forcing the closure of a lot of abortion clinics because they're imposing hospital standards on abortion clinics, which are too expensive to be met. And abortion providers argue that they're completely unnecessary in the first place.
Right.
But the people who are pushing this agenda are trying to take the moral high ground of saying that we really care about women and women's health when it hasn't been an issue up until now. But the results are very clear that they've closed, I think, 2/3 of the abortion clinics already in Texas. And if this law is upheld, there'll be only a few left, if any.
That's right. I think there's a couple of different ways in which the court might look at this case. And let me try and spell them out separately. So the current law says that a government cannot impose what the court has called an undue burden on access to an abortion, and it's looked at things like notification requirements and waiting periods, rules about must view the sonogram, things like that. Under that undue burden framework. But it's been very unclear as to precisely what counts and when as an undue burden. Now, in this case, as you say, that if one looks just at the practical effect on the ground of this regulation, it's very clear that it precludes many people, or certainly raises the cost dramatically to many people, of obtaining an abortion, right? Particularly if they're impoverished. People who have to drive sometimes a day to go to a clinic, get a procedure. The procedure might prevent you from traveling either that day or the next, although I should say that most abortion procedures are relatively uninvasive and not terribly disruptive, at least as far as I have read. And so the effect of this law would be to prevent substantial numbers of people from accessing at all an abortion, which on one view is plainly an undue burden. On the other hand, the court in a separate series of cases has denied constitutional arguments, rejected constitutional arguments, that there's a right to get funding for an abortion as part of a package of medical services. These are cases about Medicaid for the most part. And one might say that, well, the Texas law is somewhat like the funding cases, and that what the government here is doing is just saying, well, we're under no affirmative duty to help you get an abortion, and all we're doing is applying this one-size-fits-all state health and safety requirement to all medical facilities in the state. So I think that's how the argument will play out if the court focuses upon undue burden. There's another way that the court could focus upon this that you touched on, and that's on the intent of the enacting Texas legislature. And as you say, the legislature, and this is famously the legislature that acted over the attempted Wendy Brown filibuster, made the claim that it was acting on behalf of women's health. I think there's two things to say about that. The first thing is, as you intimated, that claim is pretty thin. The evidence that restricting access to these facilities is going to improve health outcomes is vanishing or non-existent. I would anticipate that quite the opposite is true, particularly because these are facilities that don't just provide abortions, they provide family planning services. The second point to make is that the claim that the Texas legislature acted out of a concern for women's health is fairly clearly spurious. This was a legislature that acted to burden or extinguish a constitutional right. And if the court focuses upon the intent of the legislature and does so in an even tolerably intelligent way, and that might be asking a lot, I recognize, it has to perceive that this is an effort by a government to extinguish a constitutional right. It's hard to imagine the circumstances where, unless you reject the constitutional right in the first place, that is at all acceptable. And so if you have Justice Kennedy, who's likely to be the swing vote, perceiving that intent to be in play, I think that this becomes a case that is much easier to win for the abortion providers and Planned Parenthood.
Well, just in the last minute then, let's touch on the other case that comes out of California, Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association. This is clearly brought forth by the anti-union movement. A lot of it's been funded by the Koch brothers and others who want to weaken or, if not destroy, public sector unions by going after their funding base. And, of course, a lot of these unions support the Democratic Party, so it's that element as well. How do you think they're going to come down on this one?
Five members of the court have very plainly signaled in a number of earlier cases, both this last term and in earlier terms, that they would like to overrule the 1970s precedent that holds that unions in public employment contexts are allowed to collect dues from both members and non-members. Friedrichs is a case about a non-member who objects to having to pay union dues. Those dues can only be used for the purposes of collective bargaining purposes. I would anticipate that the court will overrule that 1970s precedent and that the objectors to the union will win. The really interesting question that follows from that is this. Under current law, unions have an obligation to bargain for both members and non-members. And the court in the 1970s installed the obligation to pay of non-members on the understanding that unions had this dual obligation to both non-members and members when it engaged in collective bargaining. If you take away non-members' obligation to pay, then it's at least arguable, and I think that there's a very strong argument, that a union could say, look, we cannot, consistent with the First Amendment, have an obligation to represent the interests of these non-members. So I think what unions will likely do is to challenge the members non-members distinction and say, well, we're able to act solely on the basis of our of the interests of our members. And I think if that happens, what you'll see is a pretty radical change in the nature and the forms of union organizing. Not, I think, an end to union organizing. I should also add that in recent states where there's been a move to right-to-work status, and Wisconsin is one of them, the drop in unionization in public employment contexts has not been as large as you would think. Unionization remains pretty robust even in a right-to-work environment, which, in effect, this is the case is installing right-to-work constitutionally.
Well, Aziz Haque, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me, and I'm sorry for the color commentary from the 7 months.
No, I thought you made some very cogent points.
Okay.
Thank you.
A career in the law.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and he's the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal reached by the United States and 11 other Pacific Rim countries. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adam Hirsch, who's a senior economist at the Roosevelt Institute and a visiting scholar at Columbia University's Initiative for Policy Dialogue. He and Joseph Stieglitz have an article at Project Syndicate, The Trans-Pacific Free Trade Charade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Hirsch.
Hi, Ian.
Adam Hirsch, now that supposedly this TPP has been negotiated and will be available to the public, we'll obviously find out how much of a charade it is. When will we be able to find out what exactly is in this agreement, which was negotiated in secret?
Well, Ian, what happened this morning was that the trade ministers from the 12 Asia-Pacific countries came to an agreement in principles for what this international trade and investment agreement will be like. It'll still be some time before those details are made public and we can really scrutinize and understand what the economic impacts are going to be. But what we know from seeing the last outstanding issues that negotiators were haggling over in the past week in Atlanta is that this agreement has really little to do with free trade. It has to do with how the biggest, most powerful and influential special interests within each country are getting together to negotiate for what the rules for the global economy among the Asia-Pacific is going to look like.
So, in other words, this is not about free trade. This is about managed trade.
Yeah, you could say that the negotiators are trying to manage the trade in the interests of people and businesses that really have their ear. One of the areas, you know, that was the last holdout is about how far to expand intellectual property rights for different kinds of pharmaceuticals. The United States wanted to keep the testing data exclusive on some kinds of pharmaceuticals for up to 12 years. They were arguing with Australia, which wanted to keep it at 5 years. Here we're talking about not a property right that gives incentives for innovation, but really something that just raises prices for the consumers and keeps competitors out of the market from bringing new innovative medicines.
Well, we already have here in the United States, in fact, on Monday's front page of Monday's New York Times, there's a story about Valeant Pharmaceuticals International. It's headed by J. Michael Pearson, who's become a billionaire because they've been basically buying up old drugs patents and then suddenly just jacking the price up. And the article talks about a patient who's been taking Cupramine for 55 years, and then suddenly this summer Valeant, who've bought the drugs or the rights to it, they quadrupled the prices overnight, and now Medicare has to cover $35,000 for 120 capsules that this patient takes every month, and he's out of pocket $1,800 a month compared to what he used to pay, which is $366. And then we also had recently the case of Turing Pharmaceuticals, headed up by this young hedge fund guy that has become the most hated man in America. He took a drug that was 62 years old, this drug, and it was the tablets were selling for AIDS patients at $13.50 a tablet, and he jacked it up to $750 a tablet. So is this what's happened, that the U.S. that's gouging its own people have been able to get a deal so they can go out and gouge the rest of the people around the Pacific?
And that's exactly what is happening, Ian, and that's what was being fought about for a lot of the last week in Atlanta. And I think the two cases that you illustrate show that these intellectual property protections that are being implemented in agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they aren't about promoting innovation. This is creating a monopoly profit for someone that had nothing to do with the development of these medicines. And one of the provisions in the intellectual property chapter of this agreement would make it possible for patent holders to almost indefinitely extend the life of their patent, so-called evergreening the patent, by just making some very minor changes when the original patent comes to the end of its life. That way they can keep renewing the patent indefinitely, keeping others, competitors, out of the market, keeping their profits higher, and without having to make new investments in developing new medicines.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Hirsch, who's a senior economist at the Roosevelt Institute and a visiting scholar at Columbia University's Initiative for Policy Dialogue. He and Joseph Stiglitz have an article at Project Syndicate, The Trans-Pacific Free Trade Charade. So why did these countries like Australia, they have universal health care, single payer, and they are still a social democracy where they have compulsory voting, meaning that 90%, 90 plus percent of people vote, so people tend to vote in their own interests, and they tend to have protection from their government. And, you know, we're clearly becoming more of an oligarchy here, where fewer people participate, and the powerful interests tend to own more and more of our politics. So I don't understand what happened there. Is it just the clout of the U.S. in terms of having these countries, smaller countries, roll over and screw their own populations?
Well, I can't say what has happened in the case of Australia in particular, but, you know, Australia was one country that was willing and able to stand up to the U.S. demands on this. And most of the countries had already conceded that they were going to accept some higher intellectual property rights standards, even though that would mean a net economic loss for the country and for people within their countries. you know, Australia was willing to hold the line, I think in large part because it recognized that the overall economic benefit of this deal was not so great, and so that there wouldn't be a lot to lose if the deal were held up by their principled stance.
And apparently New Zealand also was a holdout till the end, largely over its dairy products, wanting to be able to export them and increase access to the U.S., Canadian, and Japanese markets that they apparently achieved. There were lots of leaks coming from these secret negotiations over the years. Is there any sense now that at least it's done or almost done? Do you have any idea of who might have been the countries leaking? And it seems like because the negotiations were conducted in secret and largely done by the very powerful interests who are benefiting from this agreement. So in effect, you know, these big monopolies look like they wrote their own ticket here. Any ideas that who might have been the leakers all along?
Although, you know, it's advantageous at times in negotiations for different parties to use this information outside to move a position, and this is part of how these negotiations have worked. So long as they're going to remain secret like this, they're going to be leakers, but it would be, I think, a much less politically contentious process and a more productive process if, all stakeholders were able to at least observe, if not participate in these rewriting of the international economic rules.
So the other big issue, of course, was automobiles. And the U.S., Mexico, Canada, and Japan apparently have agreed on rules, and already from NAFTA, for example, a lot of car manufacturers moved to Mexico, and the arguments over the content of the car, and I guess that's why Japanese and German makers have moved their plants here to the United States. So is the U.S. is supposed to start phasing out its tariffs on Japanese cars and light trucks? What's your sense of what this is going to mean for the consumer?
So in the rules of origin that you're describing, the share of content that needs to come from, be produced within a member country to qualify for the preferential market access under the agreement, I think this also points out how really this is not a free trade agreement, but a managed trade agreement. I think it also points to one of the other big themes which supporters of the TPP have arguments that they've made, that this is an agreement about writing the rules to bring China into the to hold them accountable to a higher set of standards and bring them into the international commercial norms. But the debate over the rules of origin on autos in particular, but also on other things like textiles, what the trade policy mocks call the yarn forward rule, about how much the content can come from outside the agreement and still get the benefits, shows that China's not going to be kept out of this trading partnership. They're still going to be able to get the benefits because the content requirements are so low. Things that are produced in China can pass through TPP countries and still get access to TPP markets without having to make the same concessions and lowering trade barriers in return.
So already, obviously, this is a political year, at least the year begins in November, but that you'd never know it based upon how much already we're dominated by the presidential race. Already, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who has always been pretty outspoken about the TPP, he says he's very disappointed and warning that this TPP will cost U.S. jobs and hurt consumers. And just to quote Bernie Sanders, Wall Street and other big corporations have won again. And he vowed to do all I can to defeat this agreement. So what's its fate, do you think, with John Boehner now, by the time, I think it's several months, it'll be reviewed. So When do you think it's likely to be presented to the Congress?
Well, the Trade Promotion Authority law, which passed at the beginning of the summer, sets out a very specific timeline in which things need to happen. And if you count through that timeline, we're looking to an agreement that may come before Congress sometime in the beginning to middle of 2016, just as the presidential primary campaigns have heated up and moving to the general election. And Senator Sanders, I saw a statement this morning and reacting, but, you know, he's not the only politician voicing concerns or objections to the agreement reached in Atlanta today. Certainly, Donald Trump has been quite vocal about this issue as well. And so I think both parties are going to have lively debates about this as a policy, and that's going to be driven by the political calendar going into next year.
Well, we know what Trump is going to say and what he has said, which is that this is negotiated by lightweights, and he would do better. I mean, the truth of the matter is, based upon what we've been talking about so far and what you've told us so far, Adam Hirsch, is that this agreement wasn't negotiated by lightweights. This was negotiated by all the big top U.S. multinational companies that have literally been able to write their own ticket and have gotten exactly what they wanted. And to hell with the citizen or the consumer. So do you think Trump's going to basically resonate here? I mean, how does it make any sense when he argues? I guess he's obviously saying that Obama's an idiot. He's been saying that all along, along with the fact that he was born in Kenya and doesn't have a birth certificate. But short of that, how do you think this Trump argument's going to fly when it flies in the face of logic that this wasn't negotiated by idiots? This was negotiated by a bunch of very powerful people who've gotten exactly what they wanted.
Well, my sense is that the content of the argument will matter less than the tenor of it in terms of pulling the right flank of the House of Representatives towards this position in opposing an agreement negotiated by President Obama's administration. With former Speaker of the House John Boehner stepping down, leaving Congress although the Congress has been in quagmire since 2010, you know, for better or worse, he was a moderating force on the conservative caucus. So without that, someone in that role, I think it makes it much harder for conservatives to hold together a coalition of votes with centrist liberals, Democrats, to put together enough votes to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Well, already you've got Senator Orrin Hatch saying that while the details are still emerging, unfortunately, I'm afraid this deal appears to fall woefully short. So that sounds like that might be the narrative on the right, is that it doesn't go far enough. And on the left, obviously, the narrative is it goes too far in terms of hurting the consumer. So how do you think navigating between those two things? It's just, this thing sounds like it's just entering a hornet's nest in the middle of the presidential primaries, and with all of this sort of populist anger on the political right that Donald Trump is stirring up, and with the Tea Party being the tail that wags the dog of the House of Representatives, if not the Senate, I wouldn't bet on this thing passing. How would you, as a betting man, what would you say, Adam?
Well, I'm not much of a betting man, but I would say that if the agreement were such a, you know, a politically winning proposition that politicians would be running to it, and rather than trying to keep it secret from the public and keep the public from participating in a debate about it.
So this may not be. It's being characterized as the crowning jewel in President Obama's presidential legacy.
That's what he's been aiming for with this agreement.
So the jewel in the crown is not exactly, he's not about to be coronated, right?
Well, I think, you know, there's clearly with the reaction we've seen to the news of an agreement this morning that there's a lot of hurdles left for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement to cross before it gets to become the law of the land.
Well, Adam Hirsch, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Hirsch, who's a senior economist at the Roosevelt Institute and a visiting scholar at Columbia University's Initiative for Policy Dialogue. He and Joseph Stiglitz have an article at Project Syndicate, The Trans-Pacific Free Trade Charade. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the destruction of the World Heritage Site at Palmyra in Syria.
من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي واسيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And the this destruction of Palmyra, the 2,000-year-old World Heritage Site, the ancient Roman ruins or of a city, one of the most storied and visited historical sites on the planet, it seems to be being destroyed piecemeal, as though the Islamic State is just taunting everybody and prolonging the agony. How do you see it?
Well, that could be it. It could also be the fact that these are not religious sites, that today what they blew up, of course, were triumphal arches, and that previously they had done two temples. So it might be that they just hadn't gotten around to it yet, or had changed their mind that these things should just go anyway. They come from the period of pre-Islamic period, which is known as the period of ignorance among Muslims. So there is that attitude towards archaeological sites that they have.
But the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, that is the state official sect, and they've had a tremendous influence on Islam around the world, having been propelled by Saudi Arabia's endless supply of petrodollars. There's no difference, as far as I can tell, between Wahhabi ideology and the religious ideology of the Islamic State. And the Wahhabis are destroying everything that they can get their hands on in Saudi Arabia itself, in the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, the very places that where Muhammad, the prophet, lived, and his wife. They absolutely wiped them out. So isn't that what this is about? It's not about the period of ignorance. It's about some weird interpretation of Islam.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, those people that ISIS has killed, the people who work for the Ministry of Antiquities, they were also Muslim. They just didn't adhere to ISIS's ideology. So you're absolutely right. The Wahhabis have done this before. They destroyed areas within Mecca and Medina, including the prophet, areas around the prophet's tomb, because they don't believe in tomb worshiping. They think that, of course, will take away from the worshiping of the single one God. There is a slight difference, though, between the ideology of ISIS and the ideology of everyone else. including the Wahhabis, is that the ISIS is takfiri, and that's very important for understanding how they operate. They pronounce people to be, they pronounce takfir. In other words, they say that Muslims who claim to be Muslims are not really Muslims at all, that what they are apostates, and because they don't practice the way they do, and so as an apostate should be killed. The early Wahhabis were takfiris. Actually, the story is, of course, that as soon as they conquered the areas with the oil in it, areas that were under the control of Shi'is, they could no longer be takfiris.
So the ideology, though, of these people, the Islamic State, it is apocalyptic, isn't it? They're sort of cleansing the world in order to rebuild it in their vision. Is it same as these Christian Zionists who believe that we all have to die in the lake of fire, and as our flesh burns, their new world begins?
Well, I read a lot about that. I mean, what is being done when people say that is that they're religious nut jobs. But if you actually look at it, what they're doing is they're conquering territory. And like any nationalist movement, for example, what they want to do is to ensure that that territory is as free as possible that from people who belong to a different religion or speak a different language or have a different ethnicity, et cetera. So, I mean, remember, there were massive population exchanges between Turkey and Greece as soon as the Kemalists won. And that population exchange was between people who were Christian and people who were Muslim. I mean, some of the Greeks who lived in Turkey had lived there for centuries, eons even.
So as this Islamic State expands and as Assad contracts and he's lost something like 85% of his territory, of course, there's a new wrinkle of late with Russia's insertion into the war. And of course, now we learn that Russia's going to be sending volunteers, which are these irregulars that the GRU, the Russian military intelligence, has organized, have been fighting in eastern Ukraine. They're Russia's version of Blackwater or something like that. Then you've got all these incursions into Turkish airspace, which appear to be testing NATO. Do you think this there's any chance of this thing unraveling and planes starting to bump into each other in the sky?
Well, there's certainly a chance of that. But the United States and Russia have begun coordinating once again. After the Crimea and Ukraine situations, the United States had stopped military talks with the Russians. Obviously, you can't really do that right now. But there are two things that I think are very important for your listeners. Number one is the fact that I do believe that ISIS has gotten to the boundaries that it can comfortably expand. It's surrounded now by Kurds, by Alevis, by Alawites, by Shiites. So these are people who are not going to be comfortable, and they're not going to roll over in the way that the Iraqi army did. So I don't see any great expansion continuing. The other thing is that there are two ways of reading the Russian incursion into Syria, optimistically or pessimistically. Pessimistically, what the Russians, you could read it as they're upping the level of violence there. The Saudis have threatened that they will up their level of violence as well. And they are trying to at least dent, if not destroy, the opposition to Bashar al-Assad. That's the pessimistic view of it. The optimistic view of it is the following. Putin has said that what he wants to do is to not destroy the opposition, but to even it out, to allow the government to have some breathing room so that they could take the fight on. So if the Russians are actually trying to restore a stalemate, that is the only condition upon which everybody can begin to negotiate. After all, if you're winning, why negotiate? You just might as well finish off the job. So the Russians are restoring the stalemate. Kerry is talking about a Geneva III now. So it's entirely possible that there could be a Geneva III. In order to work, it, of course, has to have Iran invited to it as well. There'll be a domestic backlash, but that's what has to happen. And there are incentives for the Russians and incentives for the United States in this. The incentive for the Russians is that they don't want another Afghanistan. They don't want this bottomless pit just throwing in soldiers and equipment and money and what have you. What they want is a exit strategy. And the best exit strategy, of course, is for them to negotiate a settlement, say they've won, and leave. For the United States, if Afghanistan is the Russian nightmare, Libya is the American nightmare. And the last thing that the Americans want is for Syria to crash and burn like Libya did. So what the Americans are probably going to end up negotiating for is getting rid of Bashar al-Assad now or later, but keeping the regime intact. In other words, keeping a banking system, keeping the security forces, keeping the power grid, all these things that are absolutely necessary for the functioning of a state. Those are things that very likely all sides can agree to. And so that's why, for the first time, there's this tiny little glimmer of optimism that I feel.
And again, I'm speaking with James Galvin. He's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. But the U.S. essentially walked away from Libya, and it's just a roiling mess, and nobody knows what to do about it. Can the U.S. walk away from? We don't have a policy, that's for sure. The Russians and the Assad's regime and the Iranians they've all been clear all along what they want, and they've done what they want. That we, on the other hand, don't know what we want, but we know what we don't want. And I don't know when, it's to my mind is that if you leave Syria abandon it like Libya, that's mostly going to impact Europe with all the refugees. So I don't understand why the Europeans aren't more engaged.
Well, let's put the question on its head. I mean, if you look at the Libya situation, of course, the United States didn't have a dog in that fight. So the United States could just very well walk away from it and somebody else worry about it. And, of course, the Europeans would worry more about Libya than the United States would. We didn't get any oil from Libya. The Italians got a great deal of oil from Libya. Refugees coming not only from Libya but from Africa, from
Nigeria, all across.
All the other places, right. Cutting through Libya and crossing the Mediterranean. They're very, very worried about that. In terms of the Syria situation, though, we have to step up to the plate for a very specific reason, or let's put it this way, the American administration feels that we have to step up to the plate for very specific reasons. There are certain capabilities that we have in that region, number one, and certain military capabilities that we have. And the other thing that we want to do is to make sure that Syria does not turn out to be a failed state, because unlike Libya, Syria is right in the middle of an extraordinarily dangerous neighborhood. It borders on Israel. There's Iraq in the mix. So the last thing that the Americans want is, for example, a destabilized Syria that could have an impact on Israel, that could also have an impact on Iraq, so fighters going crossing back and forth into Iraq take on the post-American invasion regime.
So when you say there's a glimmer of hope, I guess there's two different players involved, right? Kerry seems to be dogged, hardworking, never gives up. Obama seems to be aloof, somewhat dismissive. His press conference the other day basically castigated the press for thinking that Putin was a tough guy and by implication he was a weakling, and basically went out of his way to say that Putin is stepping into a quagmire. And is that what's going on here? I don't understand what our policy is, frankly. I never have. Or maybe we don't have one.
I think we do have one. I think it's not easy to articulate, because to articulate it would make whoever articulates it appear to be extraordinarily cynical. And that's why I don't think anybody's talking about it. I'm not quite sure if there's any distance between Kerry and Obama on this. I think that fundamentally what Obama has done in terms of the Middle East has been to send Kerry on these fool's errands, which he's been doing like a good soldier. I don't know, for example, if Kerry really believed that you could have a solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict and actually work that out within this term of Obama's. As far as Syria is concerned, we can't just say, look, you know, what would have been great in the very beginning was if Assad just crushed the thing to begin with, crushed the opposition, crushed the rebels, and that way brought the country back to the status quo where it was, had a stable border with Israel, was in negotiations with Israel, for example, which is our big concern there. And also there was no spillover of any of the jihadi stuff, the terrorist stuff that has been taking place ever since. But, you know, how does a president of the United States, particularly one who has committed himself to certain American ideals, articulate a policy like that? It's impossible for him to do that. And that's why he appears to be so powerless and spinning his wheels and forced to do nothing more than castigate the press more than he's castigated Bashar al-Assad.
So you think the cynical thing is that they actually want Assad, they wish that Assad could have just managed the situation as opposed to turning towards brutality and not compromising one iota with his own people. That's the position that we've always argued, that he should have done that.
We have argued that, but I would contend that we have to make a choice. And it's not a good choice. The choice is between humanitarian concerns and concerns for justice. Justice begs that Assad pay a price for this, that he be brought to the world court, that he be tried as a war criminal. There is no doubt about that. That's justice. Humanitarian concerns, on the other hand, demand that the fighting stop. And the only way that the fighting will probably stop is if the regime remains intact with or without Bashar al-Assad. In other words, they'll find somebody else to step in. They'll bring in some members of the National Coordinating Coalition, which is the domestic opposition, political opposition, who are fairly tame. And they'll give them cabinet posts in charge of education or public health or something like that. That's the way this thing is probably going to end up. So your listeners should really think about this. Because, for example, when we took on Gaddafi with the coalition that took on Gaddafi, and Gaddafi collapsed, and we didn't stay in, for example, because there was no basis for us to be able to do that. We couldn't do that, and we shouldn't have done that. But look what developed after that, a humanitarian disaster. If, however, for example, there was some other sort of solution that was created, maybe sending Gaddafi to Venezuela or Tehran or someplace like that, same thing with Assad, maybe doing that as well. Are we rewarding bad behavior? Yes, but it's also saving lives.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire and the Modern Middle East, A History. His latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.